Welcome to the Global Tech Leaders Podcast, where we help business leaders and individual contributors with actionable insights to hit their number and figure out the nuances of truly operating a business globally today, squeezing the essence of the lessons learned from the planet's top tech leaders. This is your guide to joining the fast track to global market scaling.
So on today's show, we welcome David Farker, who's a transaction-oriented serial entrepreneur with a track record of delivering shareholder value, currently leading a rapid growth of vertical farm manufacturer Intelligent Growth Solutions. Prior to that, he had retired following the turnaround, transformation, growth, and exit of a global enterprise SaaS vendor Workplace. Over the past 28 years, he's completed no less than 330 transactions as a founder, CEO, angel investor, and business mentor, including risk capital investments, PE, VC, and angel acquisitions, and trade sales in Europe, North America, and Asia. He started 20 companies, sold 13 of them, and has hard-won experience having lost three, where he reckons he's learned the best business lessons, and I have no doubt that is true. I think it's fair to say David wrote the book on growth, but more importantly, culture, which we'll certainly get to as well. So welcome to the show today, David.
Thank you.
Well, if it's even possible humanly to summarize your career thus far to date, maybe would you just share with us a bit about your career, what's brought you to where you are, some of the kind of inflection points, your formative years in particular, that shaped that level of company involvement at a very strategic level. If that's even possible, we'd welcome it to share with our audience, if you would.
Yeah, delighted. It's a far less glamorous story than you painted out to be, certainly when you're living it, but your words are very kind. So if I go way back, it's interesting, I was on a flight back from visiting a customer on the continent earlier today, and just chatting with one of the team about who is a very highly qualified engineer, about, you know, how you end up doing the job that you're doing. And he sort of jokingly said, well, how come you get to be the CEO all the time? And the answer is really simple. It's a combination of two things. Number one, I'm no good at anything else. You know, I've never been to university or anything like that. I don't have any profession or qualifications, really. And number two, I had actually really quite a rough childhood, which resulted in me reacting to that by saying, I am really bad at taking orders. Now, that's a little shocking for someone who ended up as an officer in the British Army, but the reason I ended up there was I did actually try to get qualified as a chef. I love food. Actually, it was hotel catering management, but I didn't have the aptitude to sit down and concentrate for long enough. I love cooking. So I learned that, but the rest of the trade, I just didn't have the aptitude for. But I'm actually married to a chef, so anything to do with food is big news in our household. So I needed to do something. I needed to get straightened out. I was, you know, having had a really rough upbringing, I was quite a bad boy. And I had an auntie who was financing me by this stage. My father had completely given up on me. And I remember standing in a phone box in Leeds in England and her saying to me, all right, I'll send you another 50 quid, but I'm giving you three choices and you got to pick one. And I thought, that's okay, three choices, Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Wow.
And I just about dropped the phone. In fact, I probably actually did drop the phone. Because I was a rock climbing, rugby playing dropout with hair halfway down my back and a beard. Anyway, I ended up, long story short, going to Sandhurst, did 8 years in the army, came out as a captain, did me the world of good, I have to say. I wasn't much into the sort of military hurrah and, you know, all the Rodneys and things, but the troops that I got to work with impressed me no end. Just their tenacity, their professionalism. And I ended up actually with more mates afterwards who had been corporals and sergeants and things than I did my fellow officers. But, you know, so that was a real lesson in, you know, growing up having to look after or look out for men, lead them, and I mean men. I know it's not politically, you know, very sensitive today, but you know, the army was very, very heavily male dominated back in the early 80s. And you know, we did. I did my tour of Belfast. You know, I spent a year with the Italian army mountaineering. I spent a tour in Germany for 2 years and so on. So, you know, I've got to see stuff, lots of different cultures and things. And I discovered I did actually have an innate sort of capability in terms of looking at a situation, assessing it, making a plan, communicating that clearly so that people not only understood what we were trying to do together, but importantly, what their contribution was and what they could expect of the guy next to them. And either that was also helped by doing an awful lot of mountaineering expeditions, which take a great deal of planning. You're putting yourself into sometimes very dangerous situations, but again, motivating people and finding that I could be successful at doing that. So I kind of reached a conclusion that it didn't matter that I didn't have a talent or a profession. And I thoroughly enjoyed helping other people to get the best out of themselves. And that is the way I see it. You know, giving people, one of my favorite phrases, permission to succeed, you know, and, you know, just telling them to get on with it. You know, I think it was the chairman of BP, I heard in an interview once saying that one of his favorite phrases was saying to people, proceed until apprehended. You know, and, you know, if you've got a talented person and they're going after, whether it's solving an engineering problem or writing a marketing campaign, it doesn't matter. You know, if they've got the skills, take the lid off them, you know, explain to them what's needed, but take the lid off them and they will be creative. They will be innovative. They will be motivated. And so I just discovered that I was actually quite good at getting other people to do all the work. So, you know, that's how I ended up as a CEO. How I ended up at IGS was pretty straightforward. I'd sort of had this career building and selling businesses and so on. Not thanks to me, but thanks to the incredibly talented people I've always been lucky enough to bring around me, who did have the necessary skills. We took over a failing business called Workplace Systems based down in Milton Keynes near London, which was backed by a private equity house. So I'd never run a business down there. I had never run a private equity backed business. So I was just intrigued. And it was Lloyds Development Capital, part of the banking group. They approached me because they tried to buy one of my other companies, a spin out from Heriot Watt University software company. We didn't sell it to them, but I got to know the guys in the process and actually we got on really well. They said, look, we've got something else. Would you come and take a look at it? And so I went in as exec chair. It was an HR software company doing employee scheduling or rostering. And it was all over the place. It had been on AIM. It had been taken private by LDC. It was about 25 years old. It had been stuck at about 9 million of revenue for a decade or so. And it was hemorrhaging cash. It was losing £1 million a year on the bottom line.
Yep.
It absolutely did not do what it said on the tin. It was supposed to be a software as a service. So software up in the cloud that people access, and it just wasn't. So they basically bought a sick puppy and they said, come in and have a look. And I thought, well, not even I can make this any worse. So I took it over in middle of 2013, and we did a complete transformation on it. And it was just so obvious what was wrong with it. The first thing we did was get rid of the existing management because they just didn't know which way was up. And then discovered there was a layer of actually really pretty talented people who'd had the lid kept on them. Underneath them. And as soon as we got rid of the management, these people began to flourish. It was like, you know, taking the black plastic sheeting off a greenhouse, everything suddenly starts to grow. And so we did a, we decided first of all that we were going to clean it up. And we did sort of two really big things, I would say. The first one was we just stopped a lot of stupidity. And in doing so, improved the bottom line to the tune of 10 grand a day. And after 100 days, we were making a profit. Now, you know, you're either a complete genius, which I'm not, or you just look at things and say, no, we're not doing that. No more junkets to Russia, no more junkets to China, no more junkets to South Africa, because you've never sold anything, blah, blah, blah. And what we also did was the team was 135 strong. And, you know, we said to them, okay, we're going to turn this from being a sort of swamp into a Viking longship, and we're going to go out marauding in the market and start winning business. Now, you have got three choices. You can stay on the pier and wave us bye-bye, or you can get in the boat. And if you get in the boat, you had better pick up a paddle, because if you're going to sit in the bottom of the boat, you're going to get found out pretty quickly if you're not contributing.
Sure.
I won't get rid of you. Your mates will. And there's nothing like peer group pressure, because if someone's working really hard or there's a team working really hard and you've got a slouch, the team will clear that person out. You don't need to be authoritarian about it if you give them permission. And so that's exactly what happened. There were people who stayed on the peer side. There were people that we got rid of because they just got on the boat but did nothing. And then there were the people who picked up a paddle and rowed like hell. We went from 135 people to 90 in about 5-6 months. So we lost a third of the entire crew actually that needed losing. Then we discovered a place in the market that had a huge problem. We discovered that big retailers, even if their footprint of their stores is actually quite small, find it really, really hard to strike a work-life balance for their workers in terms of scheduling them. So when do we need you in the store and blah, blah, blah. And how do we reconcile the needs of the business? So customer service drives sales, but you don't want to have huge turnover of people. So it behoves you not just to have people with the right skills in the right stores doing the right work to engage customers, but you need to give them a proper work-life balance. And so there was a kind of really human side to this. And it sounds a bit sort of soft and snowflakey. Actually, do you know what? It was a really tough-nosed business thing, because we discovered that the staff turnover rates were absolutely crippling a lot of these businesses. And we had big customers like Walmart, H&M, T-Mobile, and so on and so forth. And so it actually made total business sense to treat people better, give them the work-life balance, allow them to sort of, if you will, opt in to schedules and shifts. And we discovered that by doing that, you would motivate them better. Your cost of talent acquisition would go down. Their productivity and their customer engagement would go up. And so it was we made this a real win-win kind of proposition. But the only way we could do that was by galvanizing our own team, motivating them, and creating a culture that was all about teamwork, success, openness, trust, honesty, you know, all the sort of words you can imagine someone plasters on the wall, but rarely actually really practices. But we really did. And, you know, we called it culture as a platform. It was a little bit of a play on software as a service, but it absolutely was. The culture we created in that business was the platform for success. And then we got back up to 160 people. We started beating the world's largest scheduling company, American, called Kronos, to every deal. So they came trying to buy us. And 2 years after we had raised the money to pivot the business and make it a real software as a service company and focus right in on one global sector, we ended up being bought. And we returned 11.2x in 2 years to our investors. And on the back of that, I merrily retired.
What a story. My God. Okay, so I know we're going to, and John's dying to jump into culture as a platform, which we'll get to in a minute. But my question ahead of that is, what you've done there is astutely identify key stakeholders in the business that are either should be there or shouldn't be there, right? And being able to pivot on that basis. But I'm curious to know, what are the tools you use to size somebody up? What's on your clipboard when you're inspecting the team as to folks that you want on the team going forward or not? How do you assess that scenario in terms of the people skill required?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I'm not heavily into the sciencey bits of HR and stuff like that. When I took over Workplace, there was an HR person. She was a contractor. I'm sure she was perfectly good, but she kept showing me charts. And there were things like 360 degree reviews. And so you'd have a pie chart with lots of dots on it. And I was supposed to understand what that meant. And so there was one particular woman called Lisa, who we were told was really not very ambitious, not terribly great at what she does, hasn't really contributed terribly well. And I'd met this woman the day before, and actually she really quite impressed me. And we literally took the lid off her, and she flourished, and she became head of global deployments, running, you know, just about the biggest team in the entire company, and was hugely successful and has gone on to have a really good career after that. So honestly, it's more about looking at the human, seeing the human, and thinking, you know, what do I need this person to be able to do? And sometimes there are, you know, professional skills and so on, or technical skills. But a lot of the time, if you're, you know, in my position as CEO, I'm not interviewing technicians. You know, I'm interviewing leaders of people. And so I want to see what that person's style is like. I want to look them in the eye very, very clearly. And I want to read as much about them as I possibly can. And I don't mean, I mean read as in read in their face, and how they respond and how they look at you and engage with you, the way they answer, their body language. And this is going to sound all terribly unscientific, but that's because it is, because it's all about humans. And, you know, the best judge of character on the planet, bar none, thankfully, is my wife. I got away with it, but she can suss everybody else out. You know, Debbie has taught me so much about the way that she looks at people, engages with people, and so on. And I think I've learned just a huge amount from being married to her. So for me, you have to get into the fine grain. You need to understand the person. You need to give them time. And let them express themselves to you so that you can learn as much as you can about them. But, and you know, the one thing I have learned is never to hire myself.
Wow.
I think too many people look in the mirror and go, oh, you're gorgeous. We need more of you. And to me, that's the biggest mistake as a leader you can make. What you want to do is hire people that will argue black, white with you. And take a different perspective, come from a different place, whether that's, you know, their history, their skill set, whether it's stuff like gender and race and all that, and nationality and things. You just need diversity because it's like nutrition. And, you know, you sit down and you solve problems together. And the other thing is never be the smartest guy in the room. If I am ever the smartest guy in the room, we have a major problem. So, you know, surround yourself with people who have talents that you don't. And so those are the kind of things I think about when, you know, I'm interviewing people. Although, you know, I'm very lucky these days because a lot of the leadership in my current business I've worked with before, you know, and they've been kind enough to come back. And, you know, we had fun last time. Let's see if we can have even more fun this time. I don't know if that really answers your question, but if you're looking for a scientific answer, there ain't one.
I think it's a great answer. And it's funny, you know, I I say to my wife in important initiatives, you know, I'm just going to go in and be myself, you know, and she's like, oh, you don't want to do that. So I'm wondering, in terms of how you show up, okay, how you show up for other people, how you show up as a leader, is that the same? Is that the same in work as it is at home? Do you show up in the same way?
An interesting question. The cap badge of the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst says serve to lead. And I firmly believe in servant leadership. So when we have a barbecue up at our farm for the, you know, we will quite often bring in people's families so they can, you know, see where mum or dad or girlfriend or boyfriend work, go and see the farm, learn more about it. You know, we have the kids, they can bring their dogs, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'll cook the barbecue because that's, you know, I can cook. I can't do engineering, but I can cook. So I'll cook the barbecue. Debbie will help. A couple of the other leaders will help. So when I show up to answer your question, when I come into the office, I am the really old phrase, but I manage by walking about. I know occasionally it irritates the hell out of people because they're trying to cut some code and I ask them how their day's going and they'll scowl at me. But, you know, it's just getting a feel, that same feel for people, but then understanding what can I do to make them successful. So, you know, if they are in need of something that I think one of our investors can help with or one of our non-execs could help with, I'll give anybody access to our board, anybody. And our directors, our investors have learned very quickly that this is a brilliant way for them to get insights into our company that they probably don't have with any of the rest of their portfolio. And so, you know, I don't believe in big hierarchies. I mean, I was a soldier, and so I know that in a battle, it's really important to have one. Here, we're not doing war, we're building a business. And so therefore, hierarchies and standing, you know, to attention and all that kind of crap is just not necessary. So, you know, cut through the structure, engage with people, but also empower them to engage with anyone else in and around your organization. So part of my service to the crew here is, you know, if any of them are struggling with something, they can just give me a shout. And if I know someone or I know someone who might know someone, I'll help them out, you know. So that to me is me providing a service to the crew here. And I think that is an absolutely key piece of leadership. Do I do that at home? I do my fair share of the cooking. In fact, we tend to fight over the oven more than not. And yeah, I mean, my wife's been...
The ovens, David, the ovens. You strike me as the type of man who has multiple ovens.
Well, I suppose there's a top one and a bottom one. We've only got one ring working on the hob at the moment because a company named John Lewis have failed three times to install a new one for us. Wow. So you can edit that out if you wish. But
No.
So we do a lot of work in our community. I try to do a lot to support Debbie. Our kids are brilliant, and we do as much as we can to support them to be very independent people. It's quite funny.
How many kids? You have three kids. Do you have two daughters and a son, or do you have more?
With Debbie, I have a son and a daughter, and from my previous marriage, I have an elder son.
Okay.
But it was quite funny. So one of our, in fact, our head of software, is going to be doing a long walk as part of recuperating from a tough time he's had. We'd been helping him. He and his wife took Debbie and I out to lunch last Sunday. They live down near Oxford, but Gordy comes up every couple of, for 2 weeks every month and works here in Edinburgh. And they said, we'd like to take you out to lunch and so on. And my son Callum phoned Debbie just as we were about to sit down. And then just as we were getting up, Lorna phoned Debbie, and the two of them burst out laughing because they had a bet. They said, one of David and Debbie's kids will be in touch with them in the couple of hours that we're with them, because they always are. And they were laughing because they'd had a bet as to which one it would be, and it was both of them. And they said, you know, we've never seen such a close-knit family. And it's funny, I hadn't thought about it. You just take it for granted. But, you know, I definitely want to have with my kids the antithesis of the relationship that I had with my father. And I'm very proud, you know, that they've responded well to that. So if that is me providing a service as a dad, you know, and I've supported Debbie through cancer, which is completely out of and through, and she volunteers at the Children's Hospice on Loch Lomond, and supports one of the families that uses the hospice at home and cooks for them and things. And there's just I suppose we have a mentality about helping people and supporting them. And it's like, you know, at Christmas, you get so much more out of the presents you buy for other people than the ones you receive. You know, almost everybody, I think, feels that way. You know, it's great the look on someone's face. And that's how I feel about life. And that's how I feel about work. You know, it should be like that.
Well, a hat tip to you. I kind of wrangle with some similar stuff myself in my own childhood, so I can relate with respect to that presence, you know. And it always and you know what, actually, I and Ross there, and you know, testament to a lot of dads these days, I don't think they get the credibility they deserve either, you know. I mean, I know some fantastic dads and parents that are very deliberate, you know, about kind of what they want to create in their life and for their children and that kind of thing, you know. I think they're more aware than maybe the generation before us, or even the generation before them. You know, I think a lot of the time it was just kind of, you know, real survival mode. And, you know, a lot of people were kind of sleepwalking around the place. And, you know, because I guess a lot of the time they just felt their choices were fairly limited, you know. And, you know, we can go into this all over the place. But I just wanted to acknowledge that, because on the other hand, people can make excuses and, you know, they could say, well, you know, that's all I know, right? This is all I know. But someone has to break the cycle. Someone has to kind of, you know, have the courage to do the stuff that is difficult. Because, like, this stuff isn't easy, you know? It's just not easy, right? To kind of be hugely committed to a certain way. So again, I would imagine you sound like the type of leader, right, that anyone would work for. You obviously have huge amounts of discipline and testament, I suppose, to your leadership style. I see that a lot of people you've worked with continue to work with you wherever you go. So that must feel good, right?
Oh, yeah, that's enormously encouraging, I would say. And even more so because they're just really talented people and great to work with, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I want to get into the weeds a little bit, if you don't mind, on the culture as a platform. You got the concept in front of me a number of weeks ago. And not only that, you gave me some very robust collateral that I've digested since. And, you know, I've thought about it a lot since, actually. And, you know, I realized that in my own experience, when I really looked at the stuff you sent me, the companies that I know that continue to innovate or change or perform and adapt, right, they all share one quality. They leverage their strong culture as a platform. Yeah. So for context, in terms of, you know, the definition of platform, what do we mean by platform? Webster's Dictionary defines it as a declaration of the principles on which a group of persons stands, you know. And for me, it's not enough, and I see this a lot as well, right? It's not enough to declare what your culture is. You don't really kind of the culture really is what people habitually do, right? And we talked about how you show up, right? Yep. How you show up on a daily basis, how you treat other people, you know. If everybody walks through the door at 11 a.m., guess what? That's your culture, right? You have a culture of people that, you know, don't show up for work on time, or even if that's important these days, I don't know. But I've seen plenty of companies, right, state the kind of things like innovation or change or risk taking, right, as part of their culture. But when you get under the covers, like, there's no one holding anyone accountable to those attributes, right? They're not written into the hiring guidelines, and it's obvious, right, that it's just not in their DNA. Yeah. So can you talk us through I'll tell you how I'll guide this, right, if this makes it easier. I want you to talk us through the cultures as a platform in terms of maybe some of the components or whatever. So we might start with, like, what is it? Then, you know, how does it impact or serve? Then why should someone pay attention to it? And then how do you get buy-in and, you know, those kind of things. So I'll do the what, and then, you know, kind of then we can do the how next and the why next or whatever, right? But what is it? What is it, David? What is, for our listeners, what is culture as a platform as you define it?
So in my own little simplistic way, I literally meant like a wooden platform. So something you can stand on that can be elevated. Yeah. And what we needed at Workplace was just that. I mean, we ended up with the analogy of the Viking longship. We had a ship's bell in every office, and every time we made a sale, you had to go and ring, you know, the sales guy would go and ring the bell and all that kind of stuff. And, people would say, ahoy there, and welcome aboard and all that kind of stuff. And we called the team the crew. Bizarrely enough, and this wasn't me, a lot of that language has come forward into IGS, our vertical farm business, as well. But people seem to cotton on to it, and, you know, they can all make jokes about ships and all that kind of stuff. So the platform I meant literally as a physical platform, because you need something you can stand on. You need something that can elevate you. And for me, it was the changing of a culture from one of failure, one of a lack of trust. You know, we had a sales team and marketing team that hated each other with a vengeance. And, you know, there were other bits. Nobody trusted engineering. The product management process was an annual bloodbath instead of being a monthly positive. There was almost nothing wrong. The company was siloed, siloed between offices and locations, siloed between teams, and so on. So we needed something we could stand on together, something we would share in common. And, you know, what slowly emerged were the same words would come out, you know, again and again when you were doing reviews or you were talking about things or discussing behavior and things, you know, and everything has to begin with trust. Because if you don't trust each other, you can't be a team, you can't collaborate. You know, if you're going to, it takes 15 people to score a try. Okay. That's something I always say. And the great rugby is the best analogy, because you think about the different sizes and body shapes and skill sets. You know, football's not like that. Other sports are not really like that. Rugby has got this sort of extraordinary variety of sets of skills and body shapes and so on. And you've got the forwards and the backs and all that kind of thing. So if you need 15 people to score a try, you know, we need different skill sets to build, design, deploy, support, sell, market vertical farms. Okay. And so it's absolutely essential. And therefore, you know, you need to trust that when you're going to make an effort to pass the ball, someone's going to catch it. And as the catcher, you need to trust that the person who's going to pass it to you is going to do a good job as well and not give you a hospital pass. So that kind of trust is important.
And also, I think the trust, because there's nothing worse in a team environment like that if somebody misses the pass. And we don't mind people missing passes, but they miss the pass because they haven't showed up at practice, right, for the last three or four times. Yeah, okay. Right.
Yeah, exactly. So trust then comes from honesty and openness. This is just my belief. So we have to be able to talk about everything. You know, when I do an induction interview with someone, which I do when they've been here 3 months, I will always say to them, you know, you're going to see things I'm never going to see. You know, I cannot be in every room and at every meeting. And if you see something that is good, then super, let's celebrate it. We should do that. It should be fun. We should be positive. But actually, even of more value, if you see something you don't think is right or you've got doubts about, raise a question, you know, do it, challenge, because, you know, challenging in the right way can be a very, very supportive behavior. It can be a crushing behavior if you do it in the wrong way. But, you know, ask questions. Why are we doing it like that? Or I've seen it done like this, or I don't think that's morally right, or. So call the things out. You know, there's the old Donald Rumsfeld, You know, we have known knowns, we have known unknowns, and we have unknown unknowns. Yeah. And, you know, I need, you remember that speech,
yes.
You know, I tell them I need to know where the unknown unknowns are, because if we know it's there, we can try to fix it. If we don't know it's there, how the hell can we even start? So
on this journey, sorry to jump in, because it's raising more questions for me now, in terms of inculcating this, right, into the organization, right, obviously you had to level set and say, okay, you know, this is what it's going to be, right? You know, this is the description of it. This is, and I liked earlier on, I absolutely got the sense earlier on that you're a man that aligns himself with kind of simplicity and focus, right? I think focus is like one of the biggest things that relates to success and relates to clarity around kind of, you know, what we're doing and when we're doing it and who's doing it and why we're doing it and all that stuff, you know. But I'm sure most of the companies, when you went in, right, to workplace, right, most of the existing leaders or the people in there were hired to perform against existing metrics, right? And tools and processes and stuff that they believed, right, were whatever, right? Right or wrong or whatever. And so I'd imagine they're going to resist change until you give them a compelling reason why it's going to benefit them. And even then, sometimes, you know, it won't get adopted if there's any stumbling blocks that impacts their performance or whatever. How do you do that? And then when did you recognize, right, that people are starting to take to it, you know?
So I have a fundamental belief that most people are good.
Right.
And you can define good in any way you like, you know, ethical, kind, passionate about what they want to do, determined to learn, determined to deliver, determined to do a good job. So my fundamental belief in human beings when I meet them is you're probably good. Now you can prove me wrong if you like, and plenty of people do, but you know, thankfully the vast majority of people are good by a number of different definitions. And if you have bad leadership, what you usually discover is you get rid of that nasty brown froth off the top, and you've got clear blue water below. You've got really good people. They've just probably not been allowed to do what they want. So in terms of clarity, you know, I took IGS over at the end of 2017 when it was five-year-old R&D project. So it had eight people. It had never sold a thing in its life, but it had built some incredible kit. And, you know, I was motivated by tackle climate change meets feed the world. And I thought, well, do you know what? I'll come out of retirement for that. And I bet I can get a lot of the old crew, you know, signed up for it. And sure enough. So for me, you know, last year in terms of focus, we raised our Series A in 2019, top the most active agri-tech investors in the world, most of them American, and they chose to invest in little old Scotland. Most of them had never invested in Europe before. Then we, you know, 6 months, in fact, 4 or 5 months after that, we hit the darn lockdown, and trying to sell a big physical product when you can't get people to come and physically see it is really tough. But the team did an amazing job. We started selling in Q3 of 2020. And then when we got into 2021, we had this laser sharp target of doing 50 million of sales in the year. Now that was from a standing start 6 months earlier. And we just focused and focused and focused and supported and encouraged, you know, enabled, we served as leaders, you know, the people.
David, sorry, 1 second. We're at the liberty of knowing, okay, what IGS do. Just could you give us, for our listeners, could you give us 15 seconds of what IGS actually do? I think this is absolutely fascinating. And you know, I'll take responsibility for not doing that up front. Sorry.
Okay.
But just tell us what it is and how it serves? It'd be offer some great context.
Yeah. So we build vertical farms. You can go and look at it. The 3 W's, IGS.farm. We build vertical farms for farmers and growers all around the world. We do not grow crop for commercial sale, but we build the world's most advanced vertical farm design, which is modular. And it's basically insulated towers in which we can create any weather and grow on trays Michelin star quality crop in towers that have a footprint of 42 square meters and are 9 meters high. And we can replicate any climate in the world and do it anywhere. So whether you're in Alaska or Riyadh or Singapore or Dublin, it makes no difference. What happens inside our tower is exactly the same wherever. So we're really trying to relocalize and securitize food supply chains to help feed the world and to help tackle climate change. But we are doing it through the empowerment of local farmers because we think that is morally the right thing to do.
And you automate that with software, right? In terms of kind of, yeah. You know, how much sunshine, how much rain, how much whatever. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. You described it to me before as if you take like a huge football pitch and you carve it up into snooker tables. And then
exactly. Yeah. And then stack them 9 meters high and you've got 50 microclimates in one tower. And so it'll do things that no other design in the world will do because we've just got brilliant engineers.
You're quite literally growing a incredible business. You're feeling now in terms of what's the outlook for the future of that business? That sounds like there must be people looking at this now, as opposed to, you know, what it was before kind of you arrived on the scene, and there it must be kind of a mind-blown concept to people now. Are you getting great traction now? And
So you asked about focus. The focus for last year was 50 million in sales, and under lockdown the team delivered 75. So we blew our sales target by 50%, blew it out of the water. So this year, it's a different target, and it's all about deployment. So we now have a backlog of 200 of these towers to build in 30 countries across 4 continents. So there will be literally IGS farms stretching from the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada right across through Europe, the Middle East, down to Southeast Asia, South Korea as well, and down to Australia, like a big rainbow across the world. This year, it's the IGS High Five. So we need 5 super happy customers, delighted customers, as we call them, live with their farms, growing food, selling it into retail or food manufacturer or whatever in different parts of the world. And we need to deliver that as our absolute minimum this year. So, you know, the team knows that that is the target. They're laser focused on that. And, you know, from the 75 million, we aim to double our sales again. So the other 2 things we did last year while we were delivering that, we built an interactive educational pavilion outside COP26 because we weren't allowed inside because nobody wanted to talk about what is happening in world agriculture and its impact on climate change. And we had thousands of people, school groups, politicians, press, all kinds of folk came through it. I even made best friends with Extinction Rebellion, who decided that we were actually the happy face of corporate life, commercialism. Yeah. And the other thing we did was we raised our Series B. So our existing investors all followed their money. We went to market for 15 million quid and were 20 times oversubscribed. So we received 300 million of term sheets, lifting the value of the business tenfold in just over 18 months. So yes, there is traction. And yes, we're very excited, not just about the growth of the business, but about our purpose as well, because we really believe we can do some good in the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible because those two matched. You know, I remember as I was sometimes when, you know, you lead organizations from a sales or revenue perspective, guys used to get quite worried at certain times, you know, and I'd say, calm down, you know, it's, you know, we're not saving lives here, you know, we're only selling software, you know, let's put it in perspective here, you know, but some software does save lives and, you know, some solutions absolutely do save lives, you know, so it depends on your perspective there. That's a wonderful story. I'm going to put a pin in that to be continued because we would love to hear about the progress. We would also love to kind of hear more about the culture as a platform. We literally only scratched the surface on that. But as we round the corner, David, It's been absolutely wonderful speaking to you. I mean, the insights here, personally, I've learned a lot actually just in the last 15 or 20 minutes listening to your approach. I think it's a very human approach. And like I said, you know, I can see why people would really gravitate towards working with you for you to allow them the autonomy to develop and grow, you know, and with constructive feedback, and also being part of that that stable platform where everybody helps people back up on the platform if they should fall off at any time for whatever reason, you know. So look, before we finish, we always like to ask our guests, what's your superpower? I have an inclination that I would kind of guess that I know what it is already based on our conversation. But what would you describe quickly as your superpower?
Oh, goodness. Well, I do think it comes back to humility. I think it comes back to knowing you're not the smartest person in the room, and actually not needing to be the smartest person in the room, and understanding that, you know, you are going to get the job done through other people. And if there is one thing I think that helps me and helps the companies that I lead, it is that. It's bringing really talented people, taking the lid off them, and just making, you know, giving them permission to succeed, as we said earlier. So if you want a word, it's humility.
Excellent answer. And that's a unique one we've never had on the show before. And I think it's an inherently important human quality that is lost today in the Instagram world of all about me. And what was it you said earlier? Aren't I gorgeous? There should be more of me. And I think if you can disregard that as advice and take up your stance on humility, I think the world, quite frankly, would be a better place overall, if nothing else.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's thinking less about yourself. You know, people misconstrue that. It's thinking more about others, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly that.
Yeah.
Very fair. Well, look, we covered about 1%. The 99% we'll have to leave for another day just due to time constraints. But I seriously look forward to future episodes of the show. I dare say you might have a permanent slot on it with that sort of goal that you've delivered today. So thank you once again, David. I really appreciate it.
No, you're more than welcome. Thanks for the opportunity to share it.
Thank you so much, David. Again, yeah, echoing Ross's sentiments there, wishing you guys the very, very best. Certainly one to watch. And it sounds like your break from retirement is being well rewarded on many levels. So good for you. And thank you so much for being our guest.
You've been listening to the Global Tech Leaders Podcast, designed for both established and aspiring career-focused tech rock stars, as well as helping leadership figure out how to speak global in today's multicultural world. For further details, check out sf-talent.com.